Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Rebel Island by Rick Riordan, narrated by Tom Stecciotti and directed by Jane Kramer. This book is copyrighted 2007 by Rick Riordan. This recording is copyrighted 2008 by Recorded Books. Trace Navarre had given up private investigation, and with it a violent past that had buried too many friends. About to get married, with a baby on the way, he was ready to let go of his former life and finally lay to rest its ghosts. And now, Rebel Island.
Chapter 1. We got married in a thunderstorm. That should have been my first warning. The Southwest Craft Center courtyard was festooned with white crepe paper. The tables were laden with fresh tamales, chips, and salsa. Cases of Shiner Bock sweated on ice in tin buckets. The margarita machine was humming. The San Antonio River flowed past the old limestone walls. Maya looked beautiful in her cream bridal dress. Her black hair was curled in ringlets, and her coppery skin glowed with health. The guests had arrived. My mother, fresh from a tour of Guatemala. My brother Garrett, not so fresh from our long bachelor party in Austin. And 100 other relatives, cops, thugs, ex-cons, lawyers, all the people who had made my life so interesting the past few decades. Then the clouds came. Lightning sparked off a mesquite tree. The sky opened up, and our outdoor wedding became a foot race to the chapel, with a retired Baptist minister and the Buddhist monk leading the pack. Larry Cho, the monk, had a commanding early lead, but Reverend Buckner Fanning held steady around the tamale table, while Larry the Buddhist had to swerve to avoid a beer keg and got blocked out by a couple of bail bondsmen. Buckner was long retired, but he sure stayed fit. He won the race to the chapel and held the door for the others as we came pouring in. I was last, helping Maya, since she couldn't move very quickly. Partly that was because of the wedding dress. Mostly, it was because she was 8.5 months pregnant. I held a plastic bag over our heads as we plodded through the rain. "This was not in the forecast," she protested. "No," I agreed. "I'm thinking God owes us a refund." Inside, the chapel was dark and smelled of musty limestone. The cedar floorboards creaked under our feet. The crowd milled around, watching out the windows as our party decorations were barraged into mush. Rain drummed off the grass so hard it made a layer of haze 3 feet high. The crepe paper melted and watery salsa overflowed off the edge of the tables. "Well," Buckner said, beaming, as if God had made this glorious moment just for us, "we still have a holy matrimony to perform." Actually, I was raised Catholic, which is why the wedding was half Buddhist, half Baptist. Maya hadn't been a practicing Buddhist since she was a little girl in China, but she liked Larry the Buddhist, and the incense and beads made her feel nostalgic. Buckner Fanning was the most respected Baptist minister in San Antonio. He also knew my mom from way back. When the Catholic priest had been reluctant to perform the ceremony, something about Maya being pregnant out of wedlock, go figure, my mom had recruited Buckner. For his part, Buckner had talked to me in advance about doing the right thing by getting married, how he hoped we would raise our child to know God. I told him we hadn't actually talked to God about the matter yet, but we were playing phone tag. Buckner, fortunately, had a sense of humor. He agreed to marry us. We were a pretty bedraggled crew when we reassembled in the old chapel. Rain poured down the stained glass windows and hammered on the roof. I glanced over at Anna De Leon, our homicide detective friend, who was toweling off her daughter, Lucia's hair. Anna smiled at me. I gave her a wink, but it was painful to hold her eyes too long. It was hard not to think about her husband, who should have been standing at her side. Larry the Buddhist rang his gong and lit some incense. He chanted a sutra. Then Buckner began talking about the marriage covenant. My eyes met Maya's. She was studying me quizzically. Maybe she was wondering why she'd agreed to hook up with a guy like me. Then she smiled. and I remembered how we'd met in a bar in Berkeley 15 years ago. Every time she smiled like that, she sent an electric charge straight down my back. I'm afraid I missed most of what Buckner had to say, but I heard the "I do" part. I said the vow without hesitation. Afterward, we waded through the well-wishers, my old girlfriend, Lillian Cambridge, Madeline White, the mafia princess, Larry Drapuski, the retired deputy, Milo Chavez, the music agent from Nashville, Messrs. Terrence and Goldman, Maya's old bosses from the law firm in San Francisco, my mom and her newest boyfriend, a millionaire named Jack Mariner, all sorts of dangerous, rain-soaked people. We ate soggy wedding cake and drank champagne and waited for the storm to pass. As Maya talked with some of her former colleagues, Garrett cornered me at the bar. My brother was wearing what passed for wedding garb, a worn tuxedo jacket over his tie-dyed T-shirt. His scraggly beard and poorly combed hair looked like a wheat field after a hailstorm. His tuxedo pants were pinned up, since he didn't have legs, and he'd woven carnations through the spokes of his wheelchair. "Grats, little bro." He lifted his plate of tamales in salute. "Good eats. You congratulating me on the tamales or the marriage? Depends." He belched into his fist, which was for him pretty darn discreet. "What you got planned for the honeymoon?" Right then, my internal alarms should have been ringing. I should have backed away, told him to get another plate of tamales, and saved myself a lot of trouble. Instead, I said, "Nothing, really. Maya's pregnant, you may have noticed." Garrett waved his hand dismissively. "Doing nothing for your honeymoon. Don't cut it, little bro. Listen, I got a proposition." Maybe it was the joyous occasion or the fact that I was surrounded by friends. Maybe it was just the fact that it was raining too hard to leave. But I was in the mood to think well of my brother. I would have plenty of time to regret that later. But that afternoon, with the rain coming down, I listened as Garrett told me his idea. Chapter 2. He got to the cemetery at sunset, drove around it twice to make sure there was no surveillance. He doubted there would be, but he'd learned to be paranoid. The sky was blood red. Corpus Christi Bay glowed like metal on the forge. The old cemetery had iron gates and limestone markers, the oldest worn smooth by storms and gulf winds. He found the graves with no effort, one large, two small, lined up cozily on a knoll, enjoying the million-dollar view. Like they come to watch fireworks, he thought. He knelt and ran his hands along the names, as if that would erase them. The top of the smallest tombstone was lined with seashells, a cockle, an Easter oyster, a blood ark. He'd spent years collecting shells like these along the Texas coast. He'd dug them out of the sand, let the ocean wash them clean, held them up to the sunlight, and admired the pattern of their veins. Had the child liked seashells? He didn't know. He'd never even met them. The mother's obituary picture had run in the newspaper. Her smile had seemed so familiar. The dates of her birth and death. Cold had gripped him as he realized what he'd done. He'd caused this, and now there was no way to bring them back. The only thing he could do was make amends, if he had the courage. He took something from his pocket, a tiny sugar skull, grinning and blind. He crushed the skull and dropped it on the mother's grave. Never again. A flash from the bay caught his eye, a rich man's yacht coming in for the night. The afternoon had been beautiful, as unexpected as yesterday's storm. Forecasters were optimistic about a nice weekend. The bad weather was supposed to skirt around them. But he knew better. A bigger storm was on the way. He watched the yacht disappear behind the fishing piers. The Texas coast had always protected him. However far he roamed, he always came back here, putting his feet in the water, hoping it would wash away his travels and his mistakes, the way it washed sand off shells. But maybe not this time. Sunset. He had to catch the evening ferry. He took one last look at the tombstones, lined up so peacefully, long evening shadows pointed toward the sea. Then he turned to leave. The island was waiting. Chapter 3. For a guy who was rumored to have killed 6 men in cold blood, Jesse Longoria looked downright pleasant. He stood on the dock of Rebel Island as if he'd been expecting us, a jovially plump Latino in his mid-50s, smile lines crinkled around his eyes. He wore a gold A&M college ring, a navy blue summer weight suit with his U.S. Marshal's badge pinned to the lapel, and a satisfied expression, as if he'd just enjoyed a stroll with a beautiful woman. "Tres Navarre," he said. "If I were you, I'd get back on that boat now." Wind buffeted the dock. Maya was supervising the hotel manager taking our bags off the ferry. Garrett was setting up his wheelchair. We'd just endured a 20-minute ride from Marances Pass through choppy seas, and I was tempted to throw up on the marshal's shoes. "What brings you here, Longoria?" I asked. "Collecting seashells?" "I don't need your interference, son. Not this time." Thunder crackled over the gulf. Storm clouds were piling up, turning the air to a wet stew of salt and electricity. The hotel manager lumbered over with our bags. He stopped when he saw Longoria's hand resting on his sidearm.
Problem, gentlemen?"
"There was," I said. "2 years ago. Never found the body, did they, Longoria?" The marshal's eyes glinted.
"I heard you quit detective work."
"Sure. Didn't you get an invitation to the retirement party?" He stepped so close I could smell the lemon starch sweating out of his clothes.
"Who hired you?"
"I don't know what you're talking about, Longoria. I'm here on my honeymoon." I pointed behind me. Maya and Garrett were just coming up the dock. Maya, 8.5 months pregnant, Garrett, a bilateral amputee. Funny, Longoria didn't look too convinced by my honeymoon story.
"Hey, Marshall," the hotel manager said. I tried to remember his name, Chris something or other.
He was a former pro surfer, tan and well-built, but I doubted he'd dealt with many conflicts worse than deciding what kind of beer to buy on the mainland.
"Mr. Navarre isn't... I mean, they have a reservation, sir. They're friends with the owner."
Longoria seemed to weigh his options. The ferry was already pulling out for Arances Pass. The next boat wouldn't come until tomorrow afternoon. That meant he could shoot me, throw me off the dock, or leave me alone. I'm sure the first two options had their appeal.
"Bad storm coming," he told me. "I'd make it a one-night honeymoon and get off this island."
Then he turned and headed toward the hotel, the first few splatters of rain making buckshot patterns on the boards at his feet.
"Old friend?" Maya asked.
Something like that. I looked at Garrett accusingly.
"Hey, little bro, you can't blame me for that. Is there any place in Texas where you don't stumble across some cop you pissed off?"
He had a point. Besides, there are plenty of other things I could blame my brother for. We followed the hotel manager up the clamshell path toward a place where I had sworn never to revisit. Rebel Island was a mile long. Most of that was a thin strip of beach and cord grass that stretched north like a comet's tail. The southern end was half a mile wide, just big enough for the lighthouse and the rambling old hotel that had once been home to the island's most infamous owner. My father used to relish the island's history. Every summer when we came here, he'd tell me the stories. To my horror, as I got older, I actually found myself interested in them. Inconveniently placed near the mouth of the Arances Bay, the island had needled its way into local history like a sticker burr. In the early 1800s, Jean Lafitte had used its treacherous sandbars to lure Spanish ships into the shallows, where they floundered and became easy prey. Lafitte had supposedly buried a treasure here, too, in a grove of live oaks. But if there had ever been live oaks on the island, hurricanes had scoured them away long ago. The only trees now were a dozen palmettos, which, according to legend, had been planted by Colonel Duncan Bray.
Bray had fought at the final land battle of the Civil War, Palmito Ranch, 200 miles south. The last irony in a war filled with ironies. Palmito Ranch had been a Confederate victory. Bray considered it the definitive word on the war's outcome. He planted palmetto saplings from the battlefield on his family's island, refused to speak of Lee's surrender or Juneteenth or any of the other new realities. He shot at federal troops who attempted to talk to him about repairing his lighthouse, and he lived the rest of his life in voluntary exile on what he considered the last patch of Confederate soil. The island got its name from him. He wasn't the last crazy rebel to own the place. Bray's house, now the Rebel Island Hotel, was a three-story French Second Empire. It had a mansard roof like reptile skin and cedar-slatted walls, painted an odd color that mirrored the sea, sometimes blue, sometimes green or gray. The oldest wooden structure in Aransas County. It had weathered half a dozen hurricanes. Good karma, our friend Alex had told me, right before he bought the place. At the time, I'd felt like I was watching somebody buy my childhood, nightmares and all. The lobby smelled of sandalwood and straw mats. Seashells and nets decorated the walls. In one corner, a Latina maid was trying to calm down a guest, a middle-aged blonde woman whose eyes were red from crying. Chris, the manager, excused himself to go help. The blonde was saying something about a gun and her ex-husband. I really didn't want to know. A college guy in a UT football jersey came stomping down the staircase with a bottle of Jose Cuervo and a fistful of limes. He asked an older gentleman reading a newspaper on the sofa if the ferry had already left. The old man said he thought it had. The kid cursed and bounded back upstairs. Outside, thunder rumbled. The whole building rattled. "Remind me again," I told Garrett. "A quiet honeymoon? Way too early for hurricane season? What, little bro? Now global warming is my fault." "I think the building is charming," Maya said. "See?" Garrett said. "Alex! You!" Alex Huff grinned crookedly as he came around the front desk. The hotel owner gave Garrett a bear hug, lifting him out of his wheelchair before setting him back down again. The whole sight was pretty disturbing. "Damn, Garrett," Alex said. "Have you gotten taller?" "Eat me, Huff. You remember Trace? And this is Maya, his better half." Alex and I shook hands. He had a grip like a pecan cracker. He hadn't gotten any prettier in the past few years. His face was scarred from acne. His wiry blonde hair and the wild light in his eyes always made me wonder if he slept with his finger in a light socket. "Yeah, Trace," he said, pulling me closer. "Need to ask you a favor later, all right?" That immediately made me wary, but before I could say anything like, "Hell no," for instance, Alex's attention moved on. He gave Maya a hug, admired her third trimester belly. "Honeymoon, huh? Not a moment too soon." "They weren't going to take a honeymoon at all," Garrett wagged a finger at me. "I told Trace, that's no way to treat a lady. I'll set the whole thing up for you." "Yeah," I grumbled. And then he said, "By the way, I'm coming along." Alex and Garrett both laughed like this was a good joke. I wished it was. Maya squeezed my hand. "Well, I guess you lovebirds want to see your room," Alex winked at me. "Garrett's right next door. I hope that's okay." He ran up the stairs before I could hit him. Garrett cackled and slid out of his chair, then followed Alex, climbing on his hands. Maya and I got the Colonel's suite, a second-floor corner bedroom with a parlor and a bay window looking out at the lighthouse. The octagonal brick tower was 70 feet tall, so no matter what floor of the hotel you were on, the lighthouse loomed overhead. It dated from the 1850s. It hadn't worked in 50 years. As a kid, looking up at the glassed-in top, I'd imagined that the beacon light would mysteriously flicker on. It never happened, but I never got tired of watching for it. "Oh!" Maya dropped the shirt she was unpacking. She sat down on the canopied bed. I was at her side in about a millisecond. "What is it?" "Just my back. She managed a smile. Relax. Relax, I said. I remember that word like 8 months ago. I put my hand on her belly. The baby wasn't kicking. He's fine, she says. Don't obsess. Coming here was a bad idea. Will you stop? We needed to get away. Thunder boomed. Get away. Right. A sunny vacation, one last holiday before the baby arrived. Maya scooted up on the bed and tried to get comfortable. Even 8.5 months pregnant, she'd never been more beautiful. Her black hair was thick and glossy. Her eyes seemed to trap the light like amber. So are you going to tell me about the marshal?
Jesse Longoria? Just somebody I've run across a few times.
And nothing to worry about. Nothing you want to talk about, you mean?
Outside, rain was coming down in sheets instead of sprinkles. It probably wasn't sundown yet, but it looked like midnight. On the bedstand, the cranberry glass lamp flickered.
You know, Maya said, if you wanted to revisit your retirement decision...
Okay, now who's obsessing?
It's been, what, 6 months?
6.5.
But who's counting?
That's entrapment, counselor, she smiled.
Unpack for me. Then I could really use a foot massage.
We didn't see Garrett, but we heard him next door. As the storm got louder, he cranked up Jimmy Buffett on his boombox. Songs You Know by Heart vibrated so hard against the wall it might have been Songs You Know by Braille. There was another sound, too. A blender, I think. Leave it to my brother to pack his own tropical drink factory. Maya couldn't take a shower because of the storm, but she spent a long time in the bathroom freshening up. Warm water always made her feel better. Being pregnant, she missed her daily steamy hot bubble baths. She said she would take up that grievance with our kid once he was an adult. As the storm got louder, so did our neighbors. Some college kids were right above us, stomping and whooping. One of them yelled, "Hurricane party!" Down the hall, a hammer was banging. Maybe Alex and his staff had decided to board up the windows. I wondered what Alex wanted to ask me. Probably an investigative favor. An employee problem, a cheating girlfriend. Private investigators got everything, which was why I'd quit being one. Well, that was one reason, anyway. I tried to convince myself Jesse Longoria's presence on the island was a total coincidence, nothing to worry about, just like the storm. If I closed my eyes and concentrated on the music coming through the walls, I could almost ignore the hammering and the rain. The last time I'd seen Jesse Longoria had been the week of my best friend's funeral. January in San Antonio. The grass was crunchy with ice. Frozen cactuses turned to mush in the tiny gravel lawns of the south side. At San Fernando Cemetery, the sky was the same color as the tombstones. I'd come to lay fresh flowers on Ralph's grave. I found Jesse Longoria standing on it, reading the headstone. He wore a black wool overcoat and his customary pleasant smile, as if he could imagine no place he'd rather be on a bitter cold day. "I missed the funeral," he told me. "I wanted to make sure he was dead. Get off." I expected a fight. I probably wanted one. Longoria chose not to humor me. He stepped off the grave. "I never got to hunt Ralph Arguello. Shame. I would have enjoyed that." "You need to leave." "Gonna blame yourself for his death too, Navar? You never had any sense about criminals." I was crushing the stems of the marigolds I'd brought. "I don't murder fugitives in my custody. That what you mean?" Longoria's laugh turned to mist in the cold air. "You're not honest with yourself, son. You knew exactly what would happen to that client of yours sooner or later. He was no different from your friend here." He gestured at Ralph's headstone. "Where'd you dump the body, Longoria?" His smile didn't waver. "If you can't stop feeling guilty, son, maybe you should find a different line of work. Nobody's ever stopped me from doing what was necessary,
nobody ever will. He strolled away down the line of tombstones. As he passed a child's grave, he flicked a multicolored pinwheel and set it spinning. I turned on the nightstand radio. All I could get was a garbled AM news station from Corpus Christi. Tropical Storm Aiden, which forecasters had dismissed as dying, was regaining hurricane strength. Despite Garrett's assurances that it would veer north, that no hurricane ever hit the Texas coast so early in the season, Aiden was bearing down on top of us. Ferry service to most locations had been suspended. Power was down in several communities. Evacuation routes were jammed. "What's the news?" Maya came out of the bathroom, toweling her hair. I turned off the radio. "Nothing much." Thunder shook the windows. The power blinked out, then came back on. Somebody upstairs yelled, "Yeah, baby!" I stared at the clock, flashing 12:01. I was just thinking how useless that would be if I were trying to time the occurrence of a crime, when I heard the shot. Maya and I locked eyes. "A board cracking," I said. "Something slammed into the building. Trace, that was a gun." I looked at the bay window, which I'd closed with the storm shutters. I tried to believe the noise had come from somewhere out there, but I knew better. The shot had come from inside the hotel. Garrett's music was still playing next door. The college kids were still stomping around upstairs. I'd heard enough gunshots in my life. Maybe if I just let this one go, let a few more bars of Cheeseburger in Paradise play through. "Trace," Maya said, "we need to check it out. We're on vacation. They have a staff here. Alex can handle it." "Fine," Maya said. "I'll go." "No, you won't. Hand me my dress." "All right," I relented. "I'll go. Just stay put." There was a knock on our door. Garrett yelled, "Yo, arguing in there. Thought I heard a gunshot." Maya did not stay put. Neither did Garrett. They followed me down the hall as if I knew where I was going. Garrett was in a wheelchair I'd never seen before. Apparently he kept a spare on the second floor, which told me he'd been visiting the hotel a lot more than I'd known. On the stairs, we ran into the older gentleman I'd seen in the lobby. He was taller than I'd realized, almost 7 feet. With his shock white hair and his black linen undertaker suit, he was a bit disconcerting to meet in a dark stairwell. That, and the fact he was armed with a .45 Colt Defender. "I heard a shot," he explained. I wasn't sure what bothered me more, the gun or the way his hand shook as he held it. He must have seen the way I was looking at him, because he slipped the gun into his pocket. "I thought the sound came from upstairs." "I was thinking downstairs," I said. "I'll follow you, then." "Great," I thought. We trooped into the lobby, and I got plowed into by the blonde woman I'd seen crying earlier. "Whoa," I said. "Well, where are you going?" She pushed past me and raced up the stairs. Chris, the manager, came out of the office in hot pursuit. He stopped short when he saw us. "Hi. His ears were red. He was breathing heavy. "We heard something," I told him. "Sounded like a shot." "A shot?" "No, couldn't have been a shot." "Did you hear it?" "No, I mean, no. Who would have a gun?" I thought about that. The old gentleman had one. So did Maya. She never left home without her Lamaze pillow and her .357. Who else? "The marshal," Maya said, following my thoughts. "What room is he in?" Chris paled.
Come on, man," Garrett growled. "I got margaritas melting upstairs."
"You don't argue with a no-legged man who wants a margarita."
"Room 112," Chris said. "End of the hall on the left. Now, if you'll excuse me,
He ran after the blonde lady.
"Busy place," Maya said.
She started to lead the way down the hall, but I put my arm out to stop her. Pregnant women do not take point.
"Pooh," she said.
We found room 112. The door was ajar. I knocked anyway.
Longoria?
No answer. Maya and I exchanged looks.
Go ahead, point man, she told me.
Trespassing in Longoria's room didn't sound like the safest idea. On the other hand, I had Maya, Garrett, and an old guy with a .45 for backup.
I opened the door. The first thing I noticed was the broken window. Glass was strewn all over the room. Rain blew in, soaking the carpet, the dresser, and the open suitcase. Jesse Longoria was sprawled at the foot of the bed, half-wrapped in the blanket he'd clawed off as he fell. He was staring at the ceiling, a pained expression on his face, as if embarrassed that he hadn't managed to cover the bullet hole in his chest. Chapter 4 Chris ran down the hall. The wind shook the walls. The storm had taken him by surprise. After surfing the Gulf Coast waters so long, he thought he knew the weather, but he'd anticipated nothing like this. It wasn't natural the way the hurricane had turned toward them, bearing down on Rebel Island with a malicious will. If he'd known, he never would have arranged things the way he had. When he caught up with Lane, she was in his bedroom, looking through his dresser.
"Stop it," he said.
She looked up, her eyes still red. Her blonde hair was stringy and wet from the shower.
"What have you done?" she demanded.
Chris balled his fists. He stared at the picture on his dresser mirror, a photo of the beach at Waikiki. Thinking of Hawaii usually calmed him down, but now his dream of moving there seemed childish. Had he really believed he'd be able to get away from here?
"I didn't do anything wrong. Chris, I know you better than that. I would never... I'd never hurt you, Lane."
She looked down at the drawers she'd pillaged and sobbed in frustration. Chris wanted to hold her. He wanted to apologize for bringing her here. But he needed to see her so badly, and she needed protection. He knew that better than anyone.
"I'll make it right," he promised.
She shook her head miserably. The bruises on her face had faded weeks ago, but he could still imagine their shadows around her eyes.
"How many more people are going to die, Chris? You've been saying it's all right, you're going to fix it, but
I will. Right now."
He held Lane's gaze, trying to make her believe him. Whenever he had trouble sleeping, and that was often, he'd imagine her eyes, the way they shone when she was happy. He would remember the times he'd made her laugh when they were younger, in high school, before everything went wrong. Since then, he'd messed up over and over. His plans had failed, but tonight it had to end.
"Stay here," he told Lane. "I'll be back."
Without waiting for her answer, he headed down the hallway. He knew where he needed to go. How many more needed to die? One, he thought. Only one. Chapter 5 At least Jesse Longoria was having a worse vacation than I was. He'd been shot once at close range. There was no visible murder weapon in the room. Longoria's holster was empty.
"I need to get out of here," Maya murmured.
I nodded. Pregnancy had made her queasy about things that had never bothered her before. Strawberries, hamburger meat, corpses.
"Garrett," I said, "take her back to the room, please."
"Jesus," he said. "That's like a dead cop."
"Very much like one." I looked at the old gentleman in the black suit.
"Sir, would you go find the owner, please, Alex Huff? Tell him to call the police."
After they were gone, I debated the wisdom of walking farther into the room. Glass shards were everywhere. Blood and rain spattered the bed and the carpet. Whatever crime scene integrity there had been, the storm was rapidly blowing it to hell. I stepped inside. Two beds. There was an outside door. It was closed. I couldn't tell if it was locked. As I recalled, few rooms in the hotel had private exits. On the second bed,
were an open suitcase and something else, a small curl of red like a ribbon. I stepped closer. It was a set of plastic handcuffs. They'd been cut. A cold feeling started in the pit of my stomach. Alex Huff ran into me from behind. I heard, "Oh, crap." He looked only slightly better than the corpse. He had a bruise under his left eye and superficial cuts on his arms, like he'd been sprayed with glass. His clothes were soaking wet. "What happened to you?" I asked. He tore his eyes away from the dead marshal. The windows in the dining room blew out. I was boarding them up. But Jesus, what happened to him?" "You mean aside from getting shot dead? I'm not sure. Any idea what he was doing on the island?" "No. I mean..." He faltered, apparently considering something he didn't like. "Chris checked him in." "When?" "Yesterday. It's been so crazy with the storm and..." "And what?" "Nothing. Just... damn it! Why did he have to go and die in my hotel?" I studied Alex's battered face and wondered what he wasn't telling me. "Call the police. Who's got jurisdiction here? Aransas Sheriff's Department?" I can't call the police." "Why not? The phone lines are down." "Cell phone? We've never had mobile service out here." "Email, smoke signals, message in a bottle. What do you use for emergencies?" Alex's eyes got unfocused, like he was going into shock. I wanted to slap him. He needed to take charge. This was his problem, not mine. "I don't... wait! The radio. It's in the lighthouse. I was just out there checking the backup generator. I didn't even think about it." "We're on backup generator?" I interrupted. "Yeah, regular power's down, but it's cool. We got enough juice to get through the night, assuming the house stays in one piece." As if on cue, a piece of driftwood flew in the window and slammed against the wall. "We need to get out of here," I told Alex. "Radio first, then we'll try to seal that window." He nodded hazily. I steered him out of the room and made sure he locked the door behind us. In the hallway, the older gentleman was talking to three college guys, trying to convince them to go away. "Dude," one of them said to me, "is it true?" He had a mop of red hair, yellow shorts, and a white T-shirt, so he was the same colors as a candy corn. His shirt said, "OU sucks," a little diplomatic statement from the University of Texas football department. Thunder rattled the building. "You all need to get to the center of the hotel," I said. "Alex, safest place for storm shelter?" "The parlor," he said. "Right in the middle of the building, no windows." I looked at the old man, who seemed pretty calm. "You are Benjamin Lindy," he told me, "from Kingsville." "All right, Mr. Lindy from Kingsville, would you mind rounding everyone up, getting them into the parlor? We need to make sure everyone is safe. Then we need to have a group talk." He nodded. "Dude," the red-headed kid said, "a guy got shot? That is freaking awesome." Mr. Lindy turned on him, and the college guys all took a step back. The old man's expression was hard and cold as a blue norther. "I hope," Lindy said calmly, "that you are using the word awesome in some fashion I do not understand. I would hate to think you were treating a man's murder as entertainment. Now, why don't y'all help me notify the other guests?" He held out his arms, and without touching the college guys, swept them toward the parlor. I watched Lindy walk away and wondered what he would have been like 40 years ago, before his hair turned white and his hands began to shake. I imagined he rarely needed his Colt 45 to make his point. "Lighthouse," I told Alex, "let's go." In the lobby, the tearful blonde lady was standing by the sofa looking lost. As soon as she saw us, she slipped out of the room. "Who's La Llorona?" I asked Alex. He stared at me blankly. "That lady," I said. "She looks like the weeping ghost in the legend, the one who drowned her kids." Alex looked like he was about to cry himself. "She drowned her kids? I got a guest who drowned her kids? Never mind." We got to the front door, and I made the mistake of opening it. That's when I realized we were going to die before we ever reached the radio. The lighthouse door was only 50 feet from the hotel entrance, but it might as well have been a mile. The air was a blender of sand and rain and swirling flotsam, oyster shells and chunks of wood that looked suspiciously like planks from the island's boat dock. I swung back to Alex and yelled, "Forget it!" But he must have thought I said something else because he forged ahead into the storm. Like a fool, I decided I'd better follow. We skittered around like a silent movie comedy, my feet slipping on the wet path. I should have fallen several times, but the wind kept pushing me upright and propelling me forward like I was being shoved through a mob of linebackers. Sand needled my exposed skin. But, by some miracle, I didn't get smashed by anything larger. Alex shouldered open the lighthouse door. We collapsed inside, soaking wet, and Alex forced the door shut.
"Christ," he gasped. "Feel like I just ran a marathon."
He rummaged through his coat pockets, found a flashlight, and flicked it on. His face, already cut up and bruised, was now plastered with wet cord grass. He had twigs sticking out of his curly hair. He looked like a scarecrow that had just gotten mugged. I doubted I looked much better. Alex swept his flashlight around the room. We were at the bottom of a hexagonal well of unpainted limestone. Just as I remembered. Metal stairs spiraled around the walls toward the lantern gallery far above. I'd only been inside the tower once before. My memories of the place were not good. Here, the roar of the storm was muted, but there was another sound, a grinding in the walls, as if the limestone blocks were moving. I reminded myself that the tower had stood for over a century. No way would it pick this moment to collapse. The chances were better of getting struck by lightning. Thunder boomed outside. Okay, bad comparison.
"Where's the radio?" I asked Alex. He pointed to the platform, 7 stories above us.
"Great." I knew the beacon hadn't worked in decades. I wasn't sure why Alex would keep the radio up there, but I didn't ask. We began to climb. The first time I'd ventured inside this lighthouse, I'd been trespassing. I was 12 years old and running from my dad. I thought I'd escape to the northern end of the island. That's where I usually went to be alone. But as I passed the lighthouse, I remembered my dad's stern warning that the place was much too dangerous. I should never go in there. What angry 12-year-old boy could resist a challenge like that? I ran to the door and was surprised that it creaked open easily. Inside, the air was cool and damp. I shut the door and put my back against it. I tried to steady my breathing. I wanted to forget the scene I'd just witnessed in our hotel room. I probably would have started sobbing, but a faint noise from above made me freeze. Scrape, scrape, scrape. Like an animal clawing at wood. A large animal. At the top of the stairs, in a crescent of daylight, a shadow rippled, as if someone or something was up there. My instincts told me to leave, but then I heard my father's voice outside.
"Trace!" he yelled. "Come on now! I'm sorry, goddammit! Where are you?"
He sounded as if he was coming toward the door. I decided to take my chances with the giant animal upstairs. I took the metal steps as quietly as I could, but my own heartbeat sounded like a bass drum. The limestone blocks were carved with graffiti. One said, "W. Dawes, 1898. I smelled sweet, acrid smoke and the scent of fresh-cut wood. I didn't realize the scratching sounds had stopped until I reached the top of the stairs and found a knife pointed at my nose. A 17-year-old Alex Huff glared at me.
"What the hell you doing here, runt?"
I was too scared to speak. I was already terrified of Alex, a delinquent who hung out with Garrett every time we came to Rebel Island. I knew that Alex lived on the island. He made amazing fireworks displays every 4th of July. I was vaguely aware that his dad worked for the owner, though I'd rarely seen his dad. I knew Alex hated me for some inexplicable reason, and Garrett treated me worse whenever Alex was around. Behind him, the floor of the lantern gallery was covered in wood shavings. There was a 2-foot-tall figurine standing on a stool, a half-carved woman. A hand-rolled cigarette was smoldering in an ashtray on the windowsill.
"You're smoking pot," I said stupidly. Alex sneered.
"Yeah, and if you tell anyone, I'll gut you. Now what are you..."
He tensed as if he'd heard something. Somewhere below us, outside the tower, my father's voice, heavy with anger and remorse, rang out.
"Trace! Trace! God damn it!"
Alex and I waited, still as death. My father called again, but this time he sounded farther away. Alex locked eyes with me.
"You're hiding from him?"
I nodded. I was determined not to let Alex see me cry. Alex didn't speak for a full minute. He studied me, as if deciding how to kill me.
"You can't hide on this island, runt," he said it bitterly. "Come on. The boathouse is out back."
"Where are we going?"
The last time Alex and Garrett had taken me out on a boat, Alex had threatened to pour cement in my shoes and drop me overboard. But for once, Alex's expression didn't look mean. His eyes were filled with something else. Pity, perhaps.
"We're going fishing," he said, as if fishing were something grim, possibly fatal. "Trust me."
Now, 25 years later, Alex and I climbed back up those steps together. The tower groaned in the storm. In the yellow beam of Alex's flashlight, the limestone walls glistened with moisture. At last, we reached the lantern room, a circular platform surrounding the huge golden chrysalis that was the Fresnel lens. There were no wood shavings on the floor this time, nothing but a couple of crushed beer cans. The gallery's outer walls were stormproof glass, but I could see nothing through them. With the rain slamming against them, they looked more like marble. The radio sat on the table in front of us. I knew almost nothing about shortwave radios, but I did know how to tell when one had been smashed to pieces. This one had been. I started to say, "Don't touch," but Alex picked up the ball-peen hammer.
"How? What the hell?"
"Who else knew about this radio, Alex?"
"Nobody. I mean, just me and the staff."
I thought about that. I thought about fingerprints. Whoever had shattered the radio had left the hammer behind, which meant he was either sloppy and rushed or unconcerned about being identified. Either way, I didn't like it.
"Alex,
when Longoria arrived on the island, did he come alone?"
I don't know. I told you, Chris checked him in."
"It's your hotel, a small hotel. But you don't know?" Alex stared at the window. Outside, the storm was a blur of gray and black, like ink coming to a boil.
"Look, Longoria wanted a first-floor room, away from the other guests. He wanted a private exit. That's what Chris said."
There were handcuffs on the bed. "Trace, Longoria was a U.S. Marshal. Was he, by chance, transporting a fugitive?" Alex stared miserably at the radio. It was hard to believe he was the same person I used to be afraid of as a kid, the same Alex Huff who had pointed a knife at my face.
"Longoria came in late last night," he said. "A charter boat brought him in from Rockport. Chris arranged it. I had nothing to do with it. And I didn't see him come in. I don't know if he was alone, Trace. I didn't want to know."
Lightning gilded the window's silver. The whole tower seemed to sway beneath me. "We need to find Chris," I said. "We'll talk in the parlor."
"You're not going to tell the other guests?"
Alex looked horrified. "That we might be stuck on this island with a fugitive who just murdered a U.S. Marshal?"
"Yeah, Alex.
I kind of think they need to know that." Chapter 6. To get away from the old man, Chase pulled his friends into an unused bedroom.
"Well," he said, "what the hell do we do now?"
Marky rubbed his chin. He was a big guy, usually good in bad situations, but even he looked shaken.
That was a cop. Did you know he was a cop?
How was I supposed to know?
We gotta get out of here.
Ty's face was pasty. He seemed to be having trouble swallowing.
Nobody's going anywhere, Chase told him.
Listen to the storm, man, Ty insisted. There's no way we can do this.
We will, Chase said. We've got no choice.
Marky and Ty said nothing. They knew damn well he was right. Chase had done his best to pretend the murder didn't bother him. It was critical that the other guests believed the three of them were just stupid college guys, but he couldn't shake the image of the bullet hole in the marshal's chest. He couldn't help thinking it was a warning. If this weekend didn't go right, he could end up just like that. He studied Marky's face, trying to gauge his loyalty. They'd been friends, if you could call it that, for almost 3 years now. But what they would have to do this weekend, things like that could strain loyalties, make business relationships unravel. Chase would have to watch his back, and Ty, shit, the guy was a basket case. Chase shouldn't have brought him along, but he didn't trust Ty to stay quiet otherwise. He wanted the bastard where he could keep an eye on him. Chase had worked his way up from nothing. He'd gotten himself into college. He supported his whole fucking family back home. He'd learned how to make a lot of money and deal with hard people. He wasn't going to let anyone mess up his plans.
All right, look, he said, trying to sound calm. It's got to happen tonight. I don't give a crap about the storm. We've got no choice.
Marky looked like he wanted to say something, but then changed his mind. He nodded.
Come on, Chase, Ty pleaded. You know I can't. I can't stand this much longer. You know how I get.
You're gonna stand it.
Chase pointed a finger at Ty's face like the barrel of a gun.
You're gonna help us. Or you're gonna end up like the cop in there.
Ty shuddered.
All right. I'm just saying.
The old man, Benjamin Lindy, appeared at the end of the corridor.
You gentlemen coming or not?
The old man gave Chase the creeps, but he tried for a light tone.
Sir, yeah, we're on our way.
Mr. Lindy scowled, but he started down the hall.
Now we've got to play along, Chase said. And for Christ's sake, Ty, stop looking like you're going to throw up.
Well, I feel like that.
Well, don't! Now, nobody else here knows shit about what's going on. I want to keep it that way.
What about the dead cop?
Marky asked.
And Chris Stowall?
We'll figure it out, Chase said. Believe me, Stowall is not going to fuck with me again. He led his friends to the parlor. Anger made red spots dance in front of his eyes. He'd been played for a fool. This whole setup sucked, but he was going to make the best of it. He would come out of this weekend in one piece, even if he was the only one who did. Chapter 7 Even when I was a child, the hotel's parlor was decorated in dead fish. A 5-foot-long marlin curved over the fireplace. Redfish and bass lined the walls. Their frozen eyes and gasping mouths used to scare the hell out of me, almost as much as the hotel's owner. Every time we arrived at the hotel, my parents would make me sit with them in the parlor while they caught up with Mr. Eli. Garrett was excused from this ritual, theoretically because he was helping Alex Huff with the luggage, which I resented to no end. Mr. Eli had bought the hotel at public auction after federal agents seized it from its previous owner, a 30s bootlegger who had been South Texas's answer to Al Capone. Eli was eccentric in a different way. He was an old bachelor who never wore anything but pajamas and a Turkish bathrobe and slippers. He smelled faintly of lilacs. His skin was milky, his hair as black as an oil slick, and he had a strange mustache shaped like a seagull's wings on his upper lip. Years later, I realized that he must have been gay, one of those men who choose, for whatever reason, to live in a climate as hospitable to them as the Arctic is to a tropical plant. That wasn't what scared me.
It was the fact that he seemed able to read minds. He'd look at me with his watery green eyes and say, "I believe young Trace is thirsty for lemonade," or, "I see you had a hard year at school," or, "Don't worry about Alex, he means well." Whatever happened to be troubling me at the moment, in all, Mr. Eli seemed like the sort of man my father would detest, but my father always showed him the greatest deference. On our last visit to Rebel Island as a family, Mr. Eli greeted my father in his usual manner.
"Sheriff Navarre, shot anyone lately?"
"Not lately, sir," my father replied. Whether it was true or not, I didn't know. We sat in the parlor with all the glassy-eyed fish staring down at us. My mother told Mr. Eli he was looking well. In truth, the old man looked paler and thinner every summer, but he accepted the compliment with a nod. My father and Mr. Eli talked about the weather and fishing conditions. Mr. Eli seemed to know everything about the sea, though as far as I could tell, he never set foot outside the hotel. After a while, Mr. Eli asked what we would like to drink, and my father requested whiskey.
"Jack," my mother chided, "remember..."
I didn't know what she was talking about, but apparently my father did. His face flushed. He could be a scary man, my father. His huge girth was intimidating enough, and when he got angry, his eyes were as bright as a hawk's.
"I'll have a drink with our host," he told my mother. "Jack, you promised."
My father rose from his chair. The air in the room was as sharp as broken glass. He turned to Mr. Eli and said,
"If you'll excuse me, sir."
Once he left, my mother muttered a quick apology to Mr. Eli.
"I'd better go, talk to him. Trace, stay here, will you?"
That was the last thing.